We recorded this episode on July 22nd, and we did it while self-isolating at our homes because of the novel coronavirus. Many of you may be self-isolating right now, too.
So this may sound a little different from our earlier episodes, and you might hear some background noise that we usually don't have in the studio. But that's part of the new normal that we're all adjusting to as we stay home to help flatten the curve during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Of course, the new coronavirus and COVID-19 are very much on everyone's minds, and Live Science is covering the latest news on that. You can find updates on our website from across the U.S., from the CDC and the World Health Organization, and from researchers around the world.
But we also hope that by continuing to bring you life's little mysteries, we can all continue to be reminded of the amazing science that's all around us.
Thanks for listening. Keep safe and stay healthy. Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a senior writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
Each episode of this podcast introduces mysterious questions, and we think the answers will surprise you.
We'll also hear about cutting-edge research in labs and in fieldwork around the world to answer these and other intriguing scientific questions.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at a mysterious process that has shaped life on Earth over hundreds of millions of years, and that's evolution. So, Mindy, what is evolution?
Put simply, evolution is biological changes that take place in populations of living things over time.
And so that's all forms of life. Everything's going through this. Okay.
Exactly. Living, extinct. All forms of life on Earth are a product of evolution. Every plant, every animal, every fungus, every microbe. And so if you go backward through time, then what happens is that you find common ancestors for related species. And the farther back you go, the more groups that you can add to the family.
And so do you have some examples of kind of these common ancestors so we can get an idea of this?
Well, just looking at ourselves. So humans and, you know, humans are part of the primate family. So humans and apes have a common ancestor that was the first primate. Now, primates and canids, the dog family, have a common ancestor that was the first placental mammal, because primates and dogs are both mammals. And then mammals and fish have a common ancestor that was the first animal with a backbone. So the further back you go, you know, the more diverse species you can kind of group together, tracing them back to this one common ancestor. And these evolutionary relationships are described by biologists in diagrams called phylogenetic trees. So if you imagine a tree with all the branches, you know, splitting off in different directions, in these type of trees that show evolutionary relationships, the branches split where evolution takes an existing species in a new direction. And because of changes at the genetic level, a new species emerges.
Yeah, I love these trees because I feel like it's so complicated to just read words about what's related to what. But seeing sort of where they come together and then where another group comes together gives a great visual for how complex it is, but how everything is interrelated and how it, you know, evolves over time.
Yeah, it makes it really easy to just kind of understand visually how these kinds of relationships work.
And so how does evolution work? I get that, you know, that we have common ancestors, but how does it happen? How do these changes happen, these relationships?
Well, this is something, like I said, this is something that happens at the genetic level, and evolution can happen over millions of years, or it can happen just over a few generations. So what's happening is that genetic mutations, just random mutations, shape new traits that emerge in a larger population over time. So what happens is you have genetic mutations in individuals, but you're not just looking at individuals to see how evolution works. You're looking at an entire population of animals. So you have these random mutations. These are changes in DNA that sort of tweak the genomic code for, let's say, for physical traits. Things like the length of your limbs or the shape of your teeth or how potent your venom is or what color your fur is. And these are all things that help living things to survive and reproduce. Either, you know, they help them, you know, run away faster from predators, or they help them, you know, be better at catching their prey, or they make them better at hiding. And so these are all things that, you know, that help species survive.
But they happen accidentally, right? The changes happen accidentally.
Right. So let's say you have a group of animals that have, you know, that have teeth that are very round, and they are catching and eating other animals. So let's say there's a random mutation and an animal has teeth, so it rewrites their DNA so that their teeth are slightly more pointy, let's just say, you know, than their neighbors. And maybe that gives them a slight advantage. And so maybe that makes it a little easier for them to catch their prey. So they are more likely to survive and to breed and to pass that trait on. And then over time, what happens is that this trait that originated as a random mutation in a single animal is something that becomes more common in the population. And animals that have that trait are just better equipped to survive in their environment. So they are the ones that are more likely to survive. They're the ones that are more likely to breed. And they're the ones that are more likely to have offspring that can also survive. So then what happens is you end up seeing emerging that this trait becomes something that is common in the population. And this is something that's called selective pressure. So environments and ecosystems, they create conditions that favor life that have certain traits. So this is something where it's not, you know, there's no one right answer that is going to work for every animal. It depends on, you know, what kind of environment that animal lives in, what kind of food it eats, what kind of competition it has. So these are all things that can determine what traits work for that animal.
There's a cute example of this in the peppered moths of Great Britain. I'm sure you've heard this story, but there are two variations of these moths. There's the light-colored ones and the dark-colored ones. And so before the Industrial Revolution, there were lichens that covered the trees they lived on. And so the light-colored ones were best camouflaged against that. And so they were best able to avoid predation and then, like you were saying, pass on their genes. And so at that time, there were way more, the ratio was that there were lots more light-colored ones. They were better adapted to their environment. But then during the 19th century, Industrial Revolution and pollution killed off some of these lichens. And then there were soot deposits that then were deposited or coated the tree bark where they were living, and the tree bark was darker. So the dark-colored moths then had the advantage because they were better camouflaged. And over time, they basically survived the lighter colored ones and they dominate.
Right, right. And you know, we're talking mostly about animals right now, but obviously this is something that affects every form of life. And, you know, you could look at, right, I mean, you could even look at the types of plants that are, you know, that survive well in really arid desert ecosystems. They look very different from plants that you would find in a rainforest. And that's because evolution has shaped and has, you know, has shaped these traits that essentially that make it possible for them to survive in one ecosystem, whereas those traits in another ecosystem wouldn't work at all.
Right.
Something that actually we can see today as far as how evolution works is that we're seeing that a lot of coral species are starting to are bleaching and are dying off because oceans are warming and they're becoming more acidic with climate change. Right. But there are some coral species that seem to be more heat resistant. And so what scientists are looking at those very, very carefully, because as our climate is changing, we're creating a new set of circumstances that, you know, corals have, you know, have over millions of years evolved to live in certain ocean environments under certain conditions. And those conditions are changing very, very quickly. And not all species are going to be able to survive that. But by looking at which species seem like they're more heat tolerant, that's giving scientists an idea of which species might be, you know, might be in the process of evolving to live in this, you know, to live in a warming world.
Right. Okay. So then in this scenario, the climate change or the heat, the temperature would be that selective pressure on these species.
Exactly.
Okay. And where did this theory of evolution come from?
Okay, well, the first thing that we have to clarify, though, is what is a theory? Because we're not gonna spend too much time on this, but just because theory in science means something very different from how it does when, you know, when people use it kind of casually, they're like, oh, you know, like I have a theory about, you know, about who is going to win the Oscar this year for best actor. I mean, that's, you know, that's
you never know.
Well, yeah, and that's basically saying like I have a hunch, or I have, you know, like, or I guess, or I think I know it's going to happen. But that's not what a theory means in science. A theory is something that it explains an aspect of how the world works and is verifiable and tested through scientific method and through the gathering of evidence, which is very different from, you know, like the theory that somebody has about, you know, like about, you know, like who they think is really responsible for the death of JFK or something like
that. Okay. So I get that. And so then the theory of evolution.
Right.
Is a theory.
Yes, it is. So this is a scientific theory, and this was proposed by Charles Darwin, the 19th century British naturalist. So it's known as Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. So he published his explanation of this theory in the 19th century, and actually right around the same time there was another British biologist, Alfred Russel Wallace, who independently came up with a similar explanation, a similar theory of evolution by natural selection. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why Darwin published when he did, because he was like still tweaking and fine tuning and on the fence and am I ready? Am I not ready? and then he heard, oh wait, this guy's getting ready to publish the same thing. Damn, I better get this out soon.
So. And he was so right. If you think about it, everybody knows who Charles Darwin is. And, you know, while we might know who Wallace is, I'm guessing not as many people know who he is.
No, this is true. Darwin is usually you know, the one who's widely considered to be, you know, sort of the father of the theory of evolution by way of natural selection, and so he observed this, and he didn't describe the mechanism on a genetic level, but the basic idea that all life on Earth is connected and related to each other, and that the diversity of life emerged as populations were modified by natural selection, by selective pressures in the natural world. This was something that essentially was sort of, you know, put out there on the world stage by Darwin.
And so one of the examples that's pretty cool, and I think people have at least heard of, are Darwin's finches. But how do they portray or illustrate his theory?
Right. This is one of the examples that's usually held up as, you know, one of the things that Darwin observed that really sort of made things kind of coalesce as far as what evolution is and how it works. And they're not finches. They're another type of bird called tanagers. They're native to the Galapagos. And Darwin observed them when he was the naturalist on the ship, the HMS Beagle. He was on this voyage for a long time, observing animals in different places where they stopped to gather data and information and about the different species and ecosystems. So these birds, they're similar birds, but they have very different beaks. So, and what Darwin was able to figure out was that these birds had evolved from a common ancestor, but they evolved different beak shapes to fill different environmental niches based on what they ate. So their beak shapes were optimized for whatever it was that they were eating, whether it was certain types of seeds or certain types of insects. And when there are genetic changes, the genetic changes become dramatic enough that one population of animals can no longer interbreed with another population, it's considered to be a separate species. And that's what had happened with these finches. So it wasn't just that they were all like you look at like if you look at all the different breeds of dogs and how different they all look, they're still dogs.
Right.
And so they're not right. So you're not looking at different species of dogs. They're all still dogs that just have these different physical traits that have been artificially selected by people because, you know, they like dogs that are, you know, that can fit in a purse or, you know, that have or that are really skinny with long legs
or hypoallergenic.
Or hypoallergenic, exactly. That's not what was happening with these finches. These finches, while they were similar birds, they had different shaped beaks, and they were all different species. And this was for Darwin, this was sort of like an aha moment about the workings of evolution.
So this theory of evolution it's answering questions about, you know, how animals evolved, where they originated, and one of the big questions that may not seem so serious, but that has intrigued people from, you know, serious scientists, a biologist to your six-year-old, is which came first, the chicken or the egg? Does evolution have anything to say on that? serious question.
That is actually a fascinating evolutionary question. You know, like, because you think about it, you know, well, maybe not specifically, you know, the chicken, but, you know, did birds evolve before egg laying, or was egg laying something that was around before birds? And evolution actually does show that if you go back in the fossil record and you can find evidence that shows that egg laying is a trait that does predate birds. So the earliest fossil reptile eggs date to the Permian, which is nearly 300 million years ago, and possibly even older than that, because those are just the eggs that are preserved. And eggs that had sort of soft, leathery shells, kind of like turtle eggs now, probably did exist before 300 million years ago, but just don't preserve as well. So egg laying is probably older than 300 million years, and birds are thought to have evolved around 165 to 150 million years ago. So if we look to evolution for the answers, the egg came before the chicken.
So it's not an impossible question to answer, which is great.
No, and it's actually a very important, it's a very important scientific idea.
Yeah, totally. And another sort of pop culture term or, you know, question that is often thrown around or we see in headlines and it makes a big splash, sort of like the term breakthrough, is missing link. So how does the idea of a missing link, does it actually fit into evolutionary theory, or is it just something that humans have sort of come up with for, you know, a fun term?
Well, the idea of the missing link is if you're trying to piece together evolutionary relationships, you know, sometimes it's, you can sort of trace a direct path between ancestor species and their descendants, but that's not always the case because the fossil record is incomplete. And so sometimes what you'll have is you'll have this, you'll have your phylogenetic tree, and there are some, there may be some gaps in it where scientists know that there is too big a jump between species that they know are related. So, there must have been something in between. And missing link is a way to describe that. But what's more correct is calling it a transitional fossil. So something that connects the dots between related species. So not all species, over hundreds of millions of years, not all species, have been preserved. And, sometimes scientists, they do get lucky and they do discover something new that actually does sort of fit very neatly between an older ancestral form and a later species that they know is descended from that shows that, that shows like a trait that is in the process of evolving. And one example, which we wrote about recently at Live Science, is an ancient fish called, let me see if I can pronounce this properly, Elpistostege watsoni, which, and I hope I didn't mangle that too much. And that ancient fish, which lived 380 million years ago, is where we got our fingers. How does that work, you might ask?
How did that work?
So this fossil was described in March. It was found in Quebec. And so this is the first evidence of finger-like bones in a tetrapod, which is a four-limbed body plan. So scientists know that all land animals, originated from animals from life began in the ocean. And so from there, different forms emerged, some of which became terrestrial. And that's ultimately where all the lineages that ended up producing primates and hominids and humans, that's where we came from. And at some point, the fins that these water-dwelling animals had evolved shapes that then later evolved to fingers. And so this fish, 380 million years ago, had precursors of vertebrate fingers and arms. So the bones, including the humerus, the radius and the ulna, which is the forearm, the rows of the carpus, the wrist, and then the smaller bones that are organized in digits as the fingers. And this was something something that was a very recent find from a few months ago is when it was first published, that actually shows scientists like the first example in the fossil record of where this trait came from.
And so this would be a missing link, this Elpistostege.
Yes. for that thing. See, that's the thing. It's like there is, you know, there is no one missing link for everything, but there can be, you know, so-called missing links or transitional fossils for specific traits.
And so that's an example of sort of one organism or one group having the same selective pressure and developing an adaptation for that, these fingers. But other kinds of evolution also produce various adaptations. And one kind of evolution called convergent evolution, which is really neat when you look at the examples of it, happens when species that are not related, they might not even live in the same environments, and they evolve similar features. So one example are honey possums. They have these long tongues or proboscides that help them get nectar. Various other animals and whole groups of animals, such as butterflies, some moths, and hummingbirds, have all evolved to have that adaptation for a similar reason, but they're not closely related. Like you wouldn't find them on a similar place on that phylogenetic tree.
Right. This is one of the really interesting ways that evolution works, is that because, like you said, these animals aren't closely related to each other, but they had similar pressures.
Right.
Evolution came up with, and in totally different cases, evolution came up with the same solution to help them survive.
Yeah, exactly. They converged on that same solution. And another example are pandas, which
I love this one.
Are not closely related to us. They're not primates, but pandas have thumb-like appendages, just like we do.
Right, which they use for holding their bamboo, which they munch on. But thumbs are something that are, you know, that are generally thought to be specific to primates.
Exactly. And flight is another adaptation that evolved in different species for similar reasons, but converged for, you know, pterosaurs, birds, bats, insects all use flight, but they're not related to one another, or not closely related, I should say.
Right. So beyond species, these are groups of animals that are not closely related to each other at all. And somewhere along the way, evolution was like, I think we need to put you in the air.
You need to fly.
you really need to fly.
Another big question about evolution. We've been talking about evolution in one direction, but can evolution work backwards? You know, if a species evolves and becomes extinct, could evolution sort of loop around and evolve that form of life again?
That is a fascinating question.
And we're going to talk about that next. Many of us, I'm assuming, Mindy, you remember being fascinated at one time or another with dinosaurs, or, you know,
or my whole life and going on now.
Exactly. Yeah. What am I talking about?
Ongoing, perpetual.
You've always been fascinated.
Always fascinated with dinosaurs.
And so that fascination, I'm sure, has brought up some, you know, in the recesses of our minds, some type of fantasy of what it might be like, you know, if those beasts were actually alive today. And, you know I definitely used to wonder about it. My kids ask about it, not knowing if dinosaurs are alive and if they could come back.
And everybody who has ever seen any of the Jurassic Park movies.
Exactly. So that brings us to today's mystery, which is, could evolution ever bring back the dinosaurs?
First, we just need to clarify that we are talking about the non-avian dinosaurs. So these are because birds are dinosaurs that are alive today. So technically, dinosaurs never went anywhere. Yeah, we have there are some dinosaurs that are still with us, but the non-avian dinosaurs, so the dinosaurs like Triceratops and Apatosaurs and Ankylosaurs, pretty much everything except the lineage of dinosaurs that produced birds went extinct. So those are the ones that we're talking about as far as could evolution ever bring them back.
And, you know, we've talked a little bit about bringing back dinosaurs artificially, using artificial means at least. And we talked about that in another podcast.
Right. One of the things we talked about was cloning dinosaurs and whether or not that was possible.
Yeah. And I mean, the upshot is that the odds look pretty low, for one, because dinosaur survives maybe 5-6 million years. And that's not 66 million years. And, you know, that's when the dinosaurs died out. And even if we did find dinosaur DNA, say, you know, in Jurassic Park style inside a, you know, mosquito blood that was preserved in amber, you know, a mosquito that bit a dinosaur, scientists would, and they somehow extracted that DNA, they'd need to find a creature similar enough to dinosaurs to put that DNA into its egg cells. And we don't really have that. I mean, we have birds, like we said, but they're not exactly T-Rexes or, you know, Stegosaurus.
Right. And this is why when you hear scientists talking about efforts to bring mammoths back, that would involve implanting an elephant with an embryo, which is an elephant, is much, much more closely related to a mammoth than any animal alive today is to a T-Rex.
Right. Exactly. Very true. And I think George Church maybe it has a whole project working on that, which is kind of incredible. But it doesn't mean that, you know, scientists aren't trying to do this still. A paleontologist at Montana State University, Jack Horner, he heads up a project called the Chickenosaurus Project, which the aim is to create a dinosaur-like chicken. So he's not really trying to bring dinosaurs.
I love
back.
That idea, though. I'm just picturing a T-Rex-sized chicken, which is
cute and terrifying.
Is it terrifying or cute? Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a little of both.
So to do this, to turn a chicken into this dino-like creature, he and other scientists would have to give it teeth, a long tail, and revert its wings back into arms and hands. So that's the whole sort of backward evolution, perhaps. And 2015, they did clear one hurdle. They turned chicken beaks into dino snouts. That entire process took them 7 years. And Horner thinks that they're about halfway there. So I don't know. Maybe another 7 years.
Well, maybe 7 years just to do one more part. And then another seven years to do another part. Right.
Who knows if we'll ever have it.
Right. Well, okay. So that you know, that kind of research aside, do scientists think that non-avian dinosaurs might just, you know, might reappear?
So what's interesting is that, you know, this isn't a question, like, scientists have actually thought about this question. And, you know, some early paleontologists and other scientists suggested this might happen. One example is a Scottish geologist, Charles Lyell. He suggested the return of dinosaurs in 1830 in the first volume of his famous book called Principles of Geology. His idea was that fauna or animals, you know, like dinosaurs, are tightly linked with climate over long time periods, and that climate was tied to geologic changes. So his idea, which he wrote about in the book, was that since dinosaurs thrived during a time when the climate was sort of like a really intense long summer, if Earth's geology somehow reverted to what it was like in the Mesozoic, perhaps their lush forests that used to be inhabited by dinosaurs would return. And he didn't give any exact mechanism, but he said, you know, this could happen. But his argument wasn't an evolutionary argument. It was, I don't know, he didn't explain it via evolution. Another scientist did just that, and that was a paleontologist at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, William Diller Matthew, and he published his famous book, Dinosaurs, in 1915. And it was during a time that, you know, scientists, no one really understood how dinosaurs originated and what caused them to go extinct. But in a footnote in his book, I'm going to read a quote from it because it's pretty interesting. He said, "If some vast catastrophe should today blot out all the mammalian races, including man and the birds, but leave the lizards and other reptiles still surviving with the lower animals and plants, we might well expect the lizards in the course of geologic periods to evolve into a great and varied land fauna, like the dinosaurs of the Mesozoic era." So he wasn't talking about exact dinosaurs, but dinosaur-like creatures.
Okay, and all we'd need is some kind of big global catastrophe that would basically wipe out probably all the people and life as we know it today.
Exactly. So, I mean, a lot would have to happen, but it's pretty interesting that back in 1915 and even further in 1830, people were talking about this.
Okay, but what about today? What do scientists today think about the idea of dinosaurs coming back?
When asked, a geneticist at the University of Northampton, Jamel Nasir, he said that he wouldn't rule out the idea. I don't think anyone's going to say that dinosaurs are going to come back because it's not likely they will evolve to appear back on Earth. But he said that, you know, evolution isn't fixed and it's not, you know, planned. So like we were talking about, random changes lead to the evolution of species, and anything can happen, basically, he said. And evolution doesn't have to go in one direction. It can take multiple directions and going forward and backward. He said he would argue that going back to dinosaurs is more likely to go in reverse because he said the building blocks are already there.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, one of my favorite examples of that sort of, you know, that idea of evolution, you know, kind of reversing the path of a species is what happened to whales. Because whales, of course, like, you know, like all terrestrial animals, whales, you know, originated from creatures that lived in the ocean. And the ancestors of whales were, from the same, I guess if you, you know, imagine something like along the lines of a hippo. So they were, and they did share a common ancestor with them. And so whales were actually these terrestrial four-legged animals that then evolved specialized features that took them back into the ocean and optimized them for living in the ocean. And so that's just, the story of whales is just a fascinating one because, you know, you have these animals that they, you know, they started in the ocean, they came out on land, and then they evolved to go back into the ocean.
Which is sort of reverse, you know, which that's pretty fascinating. Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah, it's like evolution taking them on this. I mean, it's like you think of, yeah, I think some people think of evolution as just this process of, you know, like of optimization.
One direction.
Right. That just, yeah. That is just this linear path. And it is so not. So, and I think whales are the best example of how that path, you know, can take a species or you take an entire group of animals in a, you know, in a very unexpected direction.
Right.
So what would happen? So going back to the, you know, modern researchers who think that the idea of dinosaurs coming back is not beyond the realm of possibility, what would have to happen for dinosaurs to come back?
That same scientist, Nasir, said that, you know, of course we'd need the right conditions. And he also brought up the idea that we would need some kind of major disruption to bring those conditions about, you know, some sort of viral pandemic that would disrupt humans' genomes, a whole species would be disrupted. And that would have to happen in a way that created the right conditions for evolution to take a path toward reinventing these ancient creatures. One example, sort of one way to look at this disruption, you can look back to when the dinosaurs went extinct about 66 million years ago, and that's what set the stage for the explosion of mammals. So these huge events happen, and then other organisms take off. You know, the conditions are there at a certain time for these new organisms to come onto the scene.
Okay, so it seems like it kind of has happened before, or has it?
That's a good point, because that's one of the counterarguments that scientists make, that it really, nothing like this has actually happened before where a creature has gone extinct and then evolved to be alive again. So yes, so it hasn't happened before. And another scientist actually told Life Science that we can see animals do come on the scene that occupy a similar ecological niche to these animals. Like, she brought up the ichthyosaurs, which were marine reptiles with long pointy snouts, and they had these dolphin-like body shapes. But their dolphins today might have this same niche, but they're not ichthyosaurs. So her idea was like, this is highly unlikely, though possible. So I guess anything's possible.
Right. Well, it's also just, you know, fun to imagine. I mean, because like you said, dinosaurs are something that, you know, they really command the imagination. And these, you know, these enormous animals that lived, you know, that lived long, so long ago that there's something incredible about them. So the idea of these, you know, these massive animals living in our world is, it's kind of a fascinating idea. But just practically, how would that even work?
Right. And so if that did happen, let's just say somehow dinosaurs evolved again. And to be clear, Mindy, you brought this up in the beginning, but we do live alongside dinosaurs, but we're talking about the non-avian dinosaurs. So if an Ankylosaurus and a T-Rex were living in our forest today, looking at how humans live or coexist with other big carnivores or big organisms that require a lot of resources, we don't generally play nice with them. So, you know, in the case of lions and bears and wolves, you know, we might thrive and they could take a dive. So that's just, you know, that's an example from today of what's happening.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, you can see that. You can see that in locations all around the world that as you know, human populations grow and, you know, human activity encroaches more and more into wild spaces, it's usually the big carnivores are usually pretty quick to disappear. And in fact, during the Ice Age, where you start seeing more, you know, more human expansion, there are the large, you know, the big charismatic animals that that lived during the Ice Age, you know, the saber-toothed cats and the mammoths. There are some researchers that say that that basically humans outcompeted them or hunted them into extinction, and that's one of the hypotheses about why all of those large animals went extinct. So yeah, I know it's hard to imagine that, and the animals that are as big as dinosaurs that would have to eat as much as these dinosaurs did, that's something that could be sustainable in a world where they'd be living alongside people.
Exactly. And so, you know, what would they eat? A T-Rex apparently ate, you know, hundreds of pounds of food at a time, and it often ate other dinosaurs like herbivores. So would there be enough prey? Would there be enough space for these huge creatures to not only live and roam, but to eat and survive? And, you know, everything is so different now, you know, even their, you know, digestive systems and things like that. Scientists don't know how they would actually survive.
Right. And this is what we were talking about earlier, about selective pressure and about conditions being very, very closely linked to which animals thrive and survive. And there's a reason why the era of the dinosaurs was when it was, because conditions on Earth were very, very different then. Earth was warmer and wetter than it is now. And so that created just a set of conditions that made it possible for the number of dinosaur species that that evolved to evolve at the same time. Because, you know, obviously you can't have big herbivores without enough plants that are nutritious enough for them to grow that big. And if you don't have the big herbivores, you're certainly not going to have the big carnivores, because, you know, you're not going to have carnivores that get to grow as big as T-Rex unless there is lots and lots of food for them to eat. So all of these things are connected, and the evolution of all of these dinosaurs is just something that is just so closely linked to the circumstances of the time. That's really something it's just hard to imagine that being something that, you know, that even if random mutations in like an emu, in like one, I'm just imagining one right, emu, right. And there's, you know, there's like some mutations that start, you know, taking it in a direction that's more, you know, more like one of its ancient dinosaur ancestors. It seems really unlikely that the conditions in the world today would support the dinosaurs of the past.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, in all likelihood, we're not going to have forests combing with these beasts that have, you know, we've thought up in our minds of living again today, at least not anytime soon.
When scientists study the mechanisms of evolution, they look at an organism's genes. But researchers recently and unexpectedly discovered a type of natural selection that doesn't rely on the organism's DNA. Here to talk to us about that is Nicoletta Lanisse, a staff writer at Live Science. Nicoletta, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The story that we're going to talk about is a great example of scientists looking at an organism, in this case, a species of yeast, and discovering something really surprising. What were the researchers investigating?
Right. So this group of researchers at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco, typically study this yeast, which is called Cryptococcus neoformans, or C. neoformans for short, because it can cause fungal meningitis. And typically infects people who have weakened immune systems, primarily those with HIV/AIDS. And this fungal meningitis causes about 20% of all HIV/AIDS-related deaths. So in looking at how this yeast infects people in the first place and how that might be prevented or treated once that happens, the researchers study the yeast and how it gets into cells.
And what did the scientists discover that they hadn't expected?
So in studying this yeast in general, they were starting to find research that its DNA, its genetic material, has these methyl groups, which are a molecule that contains one carbon atom and three hydrogen atoms bound to the surface of DNA. And this attachment of methyl groups is known as methylation. And we see this in humans, we see this in a number of organisms, but some organisms over evolutionary time have lost the ability to add these methyl groups to their DNA. Why is that important? These methyl groups can actually edit DNA, in a sense, by switching genes on and off. So it's a way, it's like a tuning mechanism for how our DNA functions to drive cellular function, to allow cell survival, all that sort of thing. Now, they were surprised that this yeast has methylation on its DNA, because it actually only has one of the two enzymes required to to, number one, add the methyl groups and keep them stuck to the DNA over time as the yeast continues to replicate over and over and over and over again. They wanted to find out how this was even possible. And in studying the yeast in lab dishes, they found that without both the enzymes intact, the yeast should have lost this methylation millions and millions of years ago, within about 130 years of losing one of the two enzymes. But instead, it's been tens of millions of years, and the yeast still has these methylation points intact.
Now, evolution is a process that helps organisms take advantage of their environments. How does DNA methylation benefit the yeast?
Right. So given that theoretically the methylation should have disappeared millions of years ago, the scientists are thinking that there is some evolutionary advantage, and they think that the methylation, these methyl groups, might prevent so-called jumping genes from moving around in the genome. So these jumping genes, better known as transposons, are these genes that can change location within the genome and actually accidentally hop into the middle of very important genes that are critical for cell survival, cell function. So if a transposon hops into a place that it shouldn't be, that can actually degrade the survival, the ability of that organism to survive. So with a base level of methylation, you can prevent these jumping genes from hopping around and potentially hurting the organism. So it might be, especially for these yeast, helpful in keeping those jumping genes in place. In addition, they're finding that the one enzyme that yeast still has intact that helps to maintain this methylation over evolutionary time, they're finding that that enzyme is also important for the yeast to hack into cells to infect them. And they don't yet know why that's the case. But it seems that this yeast has also hung on to this enzyme in order to infect things, which of course would be important to potentially treating those infections in humans.
Are there other organisms in which methylation happens?
So, I mean, we are a great example. Most vertebrates and plants that you think about also use methylation or some sort of what's known as epigenetics, which is translates to on top of or above the genome. So we think of these methyl groups as being stuck on top of the genome. So vertebrates and plants are my best example there. And then organisms like fruit flies and roundworms have actually lost this methylation over evolutionary time. So they'd be an example of organisms that no longer have that ability.
And what might be next steps for scientists understanding what's happening in the C. neoformans yeast?
The scientists are looking into why the remaining enzyme, which is known as maintenance methyltransferase, which is the enzyme that keeps those methyl groups stuck onto DNA over evolutionary time, they're trying to figure out why that's so crucial for the yeast to infect cells. And that can be done starting in cell culture studies, perhaps by eliminating that enzyme and seeing what happens, or disabling different portions of it and seeing what happens, those sort of very basic science experiments. In addition, just studying the yeast as it replicates over time and divides to create new generations over and over and over again, seeing how that particular enzyme comes into play and what interacts with the DNA in addition to keep those methyl groups around would be the next step. So very basic science experiments, especially focusing on these yeast. But potentially once they figure out the base mechanisms, they could also look for this sort of new fangled evolution in other organisms as well to see if it carries over.
You spoke to the study's senior author, Dr. Haitham Madhani, a professor of biochemistry and biophysics at the University of California in San Francisco. What did he tell you about DNA methylation that really caught your attention?
He did make the point that, you know, in these laboratory experiments, the rate of loss of the methylation was higher than the rate of gain. So the system should have slowly lost methylation over time. But if there wasn't a mechanism in place to keep it intact, and that mechanism is some sort of natural selection pressure, so nailing down how that really works through successive generations is really interesting. And of course, what they're looking into now, but just kind of that idea of how much very subtle changes that, for instance, we've known about this yeast for a long time, and this only came up this year, this was only published this year. So learning new things about what significantly increases the evolutionary fitness of organisms and allows them to behave as we see them behave today. So if you don't look back at the evolutionary timeline, sometimes you miss these details. And as we're learning here, those sorts of details could be very important in a practical sense, especially in treating fungal meningitis in this case. But in general, when you're looking at these organisms, it's important to acknowledge how they got to be how they are today. It can have very practical implications in our lives.
I've been talking to Nicolette Lanisse, a staff writer at Live Science. You can read her article, Scientists Uncover New Mode of Evolution, on the Live Science website. The link is in the show notes. And if you want to keep up with the latest COVID-19 news, Nicoletta has a weekly Facebook Live video update and Q&A on the Live Science Facebook page, with a new video every Thursday at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Her updates are also available as special episodes for this podcast. Nicoletta, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. Today's evolution mystery, Could Evolution Ever Bring Back the Dinosaurs?, is available as a Life's Little Mysteries article on our website, livescience.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own, or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally. It'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals Network.